In today's second backstory segment, we'll take a look at the energy bill that the Senate passed last week. Although the bill calls for the first rise in fuel economy standards in 20 years, several key provisions supporting clean fuel did not make it into the final version. Joining me now to discuss the potential impact of the bill is Vijay Vaitiswaran, an energy correspondent for The Economist and the author of the book Power to the People. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi there. It's great to be with you.
The bill was passed by a vote of 65 to 27 in the Senate. Were you surprised that it received so much bipartisan support?
Maybe the precise numbers are a little surprising, but I think one has to look beyond the headlines. The real story in the bill is what's not in the bill, and I think that's part of the reason why so many Republicans were able to support it. It is actually more bark than bite. And Republicans are finding a lot of pressure back home to be seen to be doing something about high gasoline prices.
So they can say they voted for an environmental bill without voting for one that might very well go against their larger ideals.
Absolutely. I think that's the main reason why President Bush himself has made generally positive noises about the Senate version of this bill. So I think there's a great appetite to be seen to be doing something. Depending on one's allegiances, and it's not just a partisan question. For a number of senior Democrats, they don't actually want to change the status quo very much because of domestic lobbies back in their state.
And also because of manufacturing and mining in their state. If you're a senator from Michigan, you have to worry about how the auto industry sees a bill like this. If you're from a mining state, a coal mining state, you also have to be concerned about what the people back home think about a bill like this.
That's right. Tip O'Neill said, you know, politics is local, and we see it in action here. The key to this energy legislation is going to be what happens now in the House. And in the House, we have a public, actually rather bitter debate going on between Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, and the principal representative who acts on behalf of the Detroit auto industry, Representative Dingell from Michigan, home to the Detroit auto industry. And he has publicly stated his strong objections to much of the Democratic agenda, the leadership's agenda on energy, on climate, because, as he said, you know, very, very openly, his job is to make sure to protect jobs back in his home state, the health of the Detroit auto industry. I personally think that's a false dichotomy. I think one can take meaningful action on climate change and encourage more efficient and cleaner cars while actually creating opportunities for the car industry. We just have to look at Toyota, for example. It has now surpassed GM as the world's number one car company while producing very innovative, clean cars. But the politics of yesterday still dominate in Michigan, and the automakers are still playing that game of lobbying for the status quo because they're afraid of change. And the unions, to be honest, are right there with the automakers. It's not only a corporate lobbying, it's also lobbying from the United Auto Workers.
Is the Democratic leadership split on this? Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid described the bill as a major step forward.
The leadership is more united, but again, Representative Dingell is a senior member of the party. He's a powerful committee chairman. Nancy Pelosi has tried to do an end run around him, creating a various, you know, slightly bureaucratic, technical ways of getting around his committee. But unfortunately, the way that the House runs, he has significant power. So he is part of the Democratic leadership, and so he does have significant power. And that's one of the great uncertainties about whether the Senate bill, what little it does. It does, for the first time in 20 years, take meaningful action on fuel economy standards that may be diluted or even worse, may not make it through at all in any House version that comes through later this year.
Public approval of Congress is down to 24%, according to the latest Gallup poll. The Democrats promised that things would change if they were put back into power. Do you think this package will help improve their image or Congress's image?
So far, the evidence is not good. I mean, what we can say is that certainly there has been a fresh start. We would not have even had this conversation in the last 6 years. So there is something of a debate about energy policy. But here's the real secret. I mean, the dirty little secret in Washington is energy policy. It's easy to point to two oilmen in the White House and say, look, you know, this is obviously an energy policy that's very friendly to the industry because of the people that President Bush and Vice President Cheney hang out with. That was the allegation made about Dick Cheney's energy task force, where he wouldn't reveal who gave advice to the White House. Well, it's no big secret. He consulted with the energy industry. That's not a big secret. He is an energy man, and his views are quite public. The real secret about Washington is that there's a bipartisan addiction to oil, that the way we've done energy, thinking about, for example, reliance on Middle Eastern oil, the way that our reliance on coal, the particularly dirty and inefficient way we've organized our energy system, is actually a bipartisan result of the policies going back since before Jimmy Carter's day. It does not, if you look across the sweep of the last few decades, there's not a whole lot of difference between energy bills produced by Democratic Congresses than in Republican ones, because the set of incentives they face is more or less the same in terms of their domestic lobbies in their state, their jobs for the car industry or for coal miners. We have a much more difficult problem to grapple with that goes beyond the partisan divide.
Well, Nancy Pelosi has appointed Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts to chair the House's Select Committee of Energy Independence and Global Warming. And I'm assuming that that is an attempt to get around John Dingell.
That's exactly right. It's an attempt to do a bit of an end run, but Dingell is very, very sophisticated and crafty politician. He's using many of his years of experience to try to thwart that effort. And so far, he has been successful.
And Carl Levin worked hard against the bill being too strong in the Senate.
That's right. And despite that, the Senate was a bit of a softer target. The provisions to do with fuel economy standards do have some teeth. But here, too, there's an opt-out clause. If in the course of implementing these stiffening of regulations, essentially it would raise the average fuel economy to 35 miles per gallon, about 10 miles per gallon higher than where we are today over the next 12 years. If this was thought to be too burdensome for the industry, the White House of the day could just waive the requirements. So that really takes away the teeth. And we know how lobbying works. We've seen the last 20 years of inaction on energy policy. We've seen how in California, where they have tried and actually succeeded in pushing forward with environmental legislation, the car industry and the energy industry typically fights tooth and nail till the last moment to try to stop or reverse those. If the White House is given authority, this would put the Secretary of Energy of the day in an almost untenable position, because you can always make the case that in the very short term, there may be some economic impact of trying to meet higher fuel economy. That's almost a no-brainer. The point is,
That's a huge loophole. Is that the biggest loophole in this thing? I mean, that loophole says, well, yeah, we're going to apply all these standards, but if they're not cost-effective, we're just going to ignore the whole bill.
It is a huge loophole. You know, I think it's that's the compromise that was needed to get through the Senate. The compromise is needed to get through the House, if indeed it ever passes. Maybe even bigger, meaning it would really be something that they can ride the coattails on when they run for office in next year on the campaign trail. We did something about energy and fuel economy, but beyond the headline and the soundbite, in practice, the industry would rest secure knowing that not much will change. That's the real danger, that there's quite a cynical exercise that's going on in Washington. The leadership has every incentive to show that it's done something. Even Republicans and President Bush now talk the language of doing something about climate change, about fuel economy. But what will we say 2 to 5 years from now, when the current lot of politicians has either been reelected or gone from the scene? Will anything really change in terms of the incentives facing the industry to get cleaner? I suspect it may not.
What sort of response have we had from the environmental groups?
While there has been some guarded praise for small measures, like the fact that there's any discussion at all of moving forward on fuel economy, there's some discussion about bill efficiency standards for appliances and some of the things that the energy efficiency lobby typically argues for. There has been a tremendous amount of skepticism to condemnation of the Senate bill for being a missed opportunity. That's been the tenor of the debate or comment from the environmental community. But they're not blameless either. I think, you know, the auto industry in particular, but more broadly, the forces, including labor unions, that advocate for the status quo have simply outflanked the environmental movement. The environmental movement had an opportunity with the change of leadership in the Democratic House and Senate to really push a much bolder agenda. And what we've seen is a very poor lobbying campaign, in my judgment, just really asking for subsidies for their pet projects. I mean, that's the problem with how Washington does business. It still remains a pork barrel approach.
And we'll probably see a lot more of that in the House version of the bill.
The House is notorious. Absolutely. We're going to see much more of that. There are more members, for a start, more opportunities to put away little pet projects or ask for different constituencies' favored projects. Here's the problem with environmental groups' lobbying approach. In lobbying for a little bit of money for this wind project or portfolio standards or one favored technology or another, which has tended to be how environmental groups lobby, what that does is it actually legitimizes the process of seeing Congress as a kitty, as a source of pork barrel funding. And unfortunately, when you do that, what happens? Whenever there's a division of spoils, like we saw with the energy bill in 2005, major piece of energy, first time in 10 years, there was about $100 billion worth of subsidies of various sorts handed out to the energy industry. John McCain derided it as the leave no lobbyist behind bill. It was that bad. It was the worst bill in years. The environmentalists left saying, oh good, we got something for wind and we got something for hydrogen, we got something for efficiency. But the people who were laughing all the way to the bank were the oil and gas industry, coal and nuclear. The lion's share of subsidies, tax loopholes, breaks, went to those well-entrenched industries with much more powerful lobbyists. And so when you get a few crumbs off the table and you leave happy, what you've really done is actually provide a fig leaf for business as usual. That's the real problem with how Washington environmentalism works, is by simply lobbying for incremental change and give us a little bit of the subsidy. You're not asking to change the game. We need to move away from this system that rewards particular technologies through bureaucratic fiat and through a little bit of subsidy here, a tax break there, because the environmental outcomes will never win when you take that approach. It really calls for much more dramatic action.
Doesn't the House plan to wait until the fall to take up fuel economy standards? Why put that off?
Well, frankly, that goes back to Representative Dingell. In part, he was able to persuade the other committee chairman they can move forward only on the areas where everyone agrees.
And there are 11 committees that will contribute to the House version.
That's right. And so we're looking at sort of a, what's a camel? It's a horse designed by committee is the old joke, right? And we're looking at a camel being designed in the House where, in fact, one of the people designing it doesn't particularly want a horse or a camel. He'd rather have nothing at all. And so I think you're really going to see an ugly process unfold in the House. Now, I may be proven wrong, and I hope that I am, that there is some enlightened thinking, there's something looking beyond the very immediate short-term difficulties facing the Detroit car companies. Maybe the unions will be able to look forward beyond the short-term. Maybe there could be a magnanimous deal, for example. There's talk that has been mentioned of why not think of a grand bargain with Detroit, help the industry deal with its pension or healthcare liabilities, but in return get investment guarantees for investing in hybrid technology or other future technologies that would move cars beyond the current oil, gasoline, fossil fuel paradigm. But that kind of a trade-off would actually help Detroit compete against the nimble Japanese companies who are increasingly moving towards hybrids and future flex fuel, plug-in hybrids, ethanol. There's a range of car technologies. I mean, this is an area that's just exploding, and the U.S. industry is, by and large, lagging. I could imagine that kind of a deal that says, we understand you have a problem, that workers have a problem. Washington can act as a broker to help if you agree to invest in these new technologies, and we'll help you with that. Unfortunately, that's not what the House is talking about. And that's why I fear what's happening is a cynical political exercise.
My guest is Vijay Vaitheeswaran, who is a correspondent for The Economist and the author of the book Power for the People, to the People, I'm sorry. Energy independence is a phrase that's been used a lot in discussing this bill, and it comes up a lot in the campaign trail now. What does it mean? Is it referring to a particular type of alternative fuel, do you think?
Well, whenever I hear the phrase energy independence, I try to run for the hills. It's almost certainly sure to be followed by a stream of demagoguery and an ill-conceived plan that ultimately means subsidize these technologies that my constituents or my lobbyists favor.
So corn growers in the corn states, ethanol, any place where the agribusiness might get some of the action?
Not only, although the corn ethanol happens to be the current offender. I mean, ethanol itself may be a very good fuel, but the way we make it in the Midwest from corn is incredibly expensive, environmentally damaging. It's the wrong way to do it. And because of the power of Midwestern farmers, we not only are giving huge subsidies for the production of ethanol in various ways, we are very unfairly blocking through tariffs the environmentally friendly ethanol that Brazil makes using sugarcane. Now, sugarcane is actually an environmentally benign and global warming-friendly way to make ethanol. They make it very efficiently. They could supply the U.S., but we put up an artificial tariff barrier to protect our corn farmers, whom we're subsidizing in the first place. It's really an example of, you know, American politics at its worst, the most craven part of the American political process, along with agricultural subsidies, and this is very similar to that, corn subsidies for ethanol. It's a textbook case of how not to do it. Well, guess what? That is the centerpiece of American energy policy today.
At one point, there was an effort to fund exploring the use of liquefied coal as an alternative fuel. Can coal be seen as an alternative fuel?
This is, again, going back to this energy independence scam. I think if people, of course, there's always some well-intentioned people who use it, but by and large, be very, very careful when people advocate technologies on behalf of energy independence. As long as the U.S. uses a drop of gasoline, we will not be independent in any meaningful sense. And that's because, you know, we consume about half the world's gasoline production every day, but we sit on only 3% of the world's oil reserves. And that includes Anwar in Alaska or any other protected lands. I mean, that includes all of our oil reserves. It's meaningless to talk about energy independence as long as we use a drop of oil. So we really have to think about moving beyond gasoline to other kinds of technologies. Now, I will say a word. It's not outrageous to think about a world in which coal can play a role, but it's not liquid coal the way people are talking about it. That is a particularly dirty way of using it. There are technologies, nerds call them carbon capture and sequestration. I mean, there's a way of using the energy in coal without getting into all the details that is consistent with global warming goals, that's consistent with environmental goals, and consistent with energy independence. In fact, I think that has to be one of the bets on the table, simply because the U.S., China, South Africa, India, you know, the great giants of the 21st century economy all have vast reserves of coal. We need to get the technologies for using it in a carbon-friendly way at a price that everyone can afford. That's actually one of the things that even some of the more progressive environmentalists, like, for example, the NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, one of the country's most respected environmental groups, publicly says we must support finding ways to use coal in carbon-friendly ways, things like carbon capture, sequestration, and that has made them very unpopular with other environmental groups that want to use the cliche of there's no such thing as clean coal. Well, you know, there is some smart thinking in the environmental camp. Coal has to be part of the solution.
But not liquefied
but
coal.
But not the scam of liquid coal.
And the New York Times reported the possibility, and suddenly it disappeared from the Senate version of the bill. Do you think it can be put back in the House version?
I think now awareness is increasing. In this, the environmental movement has found a quick whipping boy. We saw this in how Senator Obama initially and almost certainly without really fully understanding the issue came out in support of that liquid coal approach and had to do a U-turn and had to explain his position because he was educated, quote-unquote, by the environmental lobby and by the public backlash. And I think it's good. One should be educated about this. There are bad ways to use coal. The energy industry will try to use the cheapest, you know, the approach possible because that's in their self-interest. But we have to look beyond that and force the coal industry to invest in more difficult but nevertheless ultimately necessary ways of using coal. Coal's going to be part of the solution. Let's not let the industry get off the hook by doing it in a dirty way. We don't need to do that.
Well, that was killed, but another provision that didn't make it into the final bill was a mandate that 15% of the power that utilities produce would have to come from clean energy sources like solar power and wind power. Why was that voted down? That sounds to me like something that everybody in the Senate could vote for.
Not if you have strong coal interests. I mean, let's remember that if you increase the share for renewables, it's coming at the expense of something else. At the margin, coal is right now the cheapest way to produce electricity. And natural gas, if you look in the last 10 years, almost all of the new capacity that has come on at the margin has been natural gas. And so if you're talking about dramatically increasing the renewables, it doesn't come out of thin air. It comes out of the hide of potential new coal plants or potential natural gas plants. So you're actually finding the fossil fuel lobby and their friends in Congress were the ones who were threatened by that. That's what is the real backstory there.
If this bill is a missed opportunity, what will it take for Congress to pass a serious energy bill? Is a clean energy bill something of a really hard sell?
It is a really hard sell for the following reason. The beneficiaries are dispersed, meaning all Americans would benefit from cleaner air, will ultimately benefit from a more secure energy system. There might be some transition costs in the short term. It might mean we have to swallow slightly higher electricity or gasoline prices, for example, while alternatives get up to speed, get into the marketplace. And that's a really hard sell to work for a group of beneficiaries who are very dispersed, 300 million Americans, who don't like to think every day about electricity or gasoline prices. And when they think about it, what do we want? We want lower prices, right? That's all really we think about, opinion polls show. Whereas the vested interests who are threatened by change are very concentrated, they're very sophisticated at lobbying, and they are old-timers at the game of lobbying Washington. So the losers are concentrated and powerful. The potential winners from a transition to clean energy are dispersed. I mean, it's a classic political science problem.
And while many people are moving to smaller, more fuel-efficiency cars, others do not want to give up their SUVs or the gas guzzlers.
I think that the real way forward is to encourage technologies that help us achieve mobility, the standards of living that Americans want and deserve, in my view, and we enjoy, while meeting the environmental challenges. Now, I firmly believe, and many of my friends in the environmental community get upset when I say this, that Americans will not live like the Europeans or the Japanese. We are a continental nation, and outside of very small enclaves like Manhattan or San Francisco or D.C., where we have good public transportation, you need a car.
We have to leave it there, Vijay. Thank you so much for talking with us. Vijay Vaitiswaran of The Economist, also the author of the book Power to the People. Thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, The New Yorker's Ken Auletta tells us about Rupert Murdoch's maneuvers to purchase Dow Jones and the reaction within The Wall Street Journal. Also, the New York premiere of a 1905 comedy by Sir John Hankin and why so few people have heard of this fine playwright. Plus, Shakespeare in the Park, staging of Romeo and Juliet. And we'll also find out just what services U.S. lobbyists are willing to offer to leaders of oppressive regimes. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn, Paula Crossfield, Tom Lisi, Scott Goldberg, and Kim Gittleson. Jay Cowett was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.